now in session. Please be seated.
Morning, council. Ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. May I please report? Good morning, Justices, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. My name is Robert Goff. I'm representing the appellant, Donnell Collins. This is a simple question on appeal. The essential procedural background, which isn't really mentioned to a great degree in the brief and which perhaps might be helpful to the court, is that this is what was called a fast-track violation of probation. I know Your Honors are probably familiar with it, but I'm going to outline it briefly because I think that it presents a relevant background in which the appellate issue can be framed.
Is this a procedure that's unique to Newcastle County, or is it one that's in all three counties? Do you know?
Your Honor, I didn't practice law in Kent County when Fast Track was developed in Newcastle County, so I do not know the answer to that question. But essentially, in
Fast Track, the same as Track 1?
I don't know Track 1 versus Track 2, Your Honor. This particular, I can describe what I perceive it to be.
Because Track 1 and Track 2 exist in all three counties.
Very well, Your Honor.
We'll let you get back on track.
Okay. I needed that. Thank you, Your Honor. Essentially, in this particular case, this is a classic fast track in the sense that the client was on probation at a superior court, and he had been arrested for superior court felony charges in Newcastle County. And about 10 or so years ago, maybe longer than that, a process was developed whereby the violation of probation based upon the new crime would take place, the hearing would take place prior to the actual conviction. Prior to that, on a general basis, that didn't happen that way. It was reversed. In this particular case, the only allegation of violation of probation is the crime, the new crime of burglary against Mr. Collins. And the only evidence against him is the allegations of his ex-girlfriend and of his aunt, who are alleged to have seen him enter the residence forcibly, cause some damage, and make some threats.
Do we know from this record what happened? Was there a subsequent prosecution, and what happened in that?
Not from this record, but I, as an officer of the court, can represent to you what occurred after the filing of this brief, if you would like, if Your Honors would like. I do not know. Yes, I know.
Well, I'd like to know. What happened?
Okay. It was dismissed because the witnesses did not appear for trial. And I didn't add that in because I thought that would be sort of cooking the books a little bit, and the inquiry was made by the judge at the time, and that's sort of, she didn't know that was going to happen at the time. But it does outline what part of the problem is with this procedure on this particular case. And that is that the credibility of the accusatory witnesses in this case, the ex-girlfriend and the aunt, were not really subject to an assessment by the judge in this case. I suppose that the police officer probably made some sort of credibility assessment in his investigation. He looked at the scene, he saw the damage and the brick rack thrown around and said that that was corroboratory, which is fine for the portion of his inquiry at that point of the time. He then swore out a warrant without seeing my client, because my client wasn't there, and arrest him about 6 days later. Took my client's statement. My client said he wasn't there, didn't do it, didn't have any involvement in this. So the police officer wouldn't have known that at the time. The judge in the trial in the violation of probation did know that. So essentially what we have is competing hearsay statements, one from my client saying he didn't do it, and two from the witnesses saying that he did do it. Really, none of them are subject to much assessment of credibility by the hearing judge.
When you say hearsay from your client, was he at the probation hearing?
He was at the probation hearing.
He just didn't testify?
He did not testify. And since it wasn't an admission, I assume that that's hearsay. And so that's how that went. The Brown case is an old case. It's from 1968, and that is essentially the case upon which I based this appeal. If you look at the cases that followed, I've never really found any case that from this court which followed Brown and reversed another violation of probation, because usually there was some kind of admission or some observation by a probation officer to formulate a basis instead of all the other hearsay comes in. Brown is not clear as to whether it's based in a rule of evidence or whether it's based in due process, or whether it's sort of a prudential rule like corpus delicti, where you have to have something other than a defendant's confession to convict him, and I have some other evidence. It's not really clear where Brown comes from. I can tell you that, or I would submit, Your Honor, that under these particular circumstances, some of the rationales as to why a probation hearing is less rigorous in terms of the protections afforded a defendant don't necessarily apply. First off, we're not dealing with a probation officer's investigation of a probationer client. And I would submit to the court that probation officers are in somewhat more unique position than a police officer is to a defendant. Their general job is to protect the community to some extent, but their job is also to rehabilitate and to monitor the behavior of their client or the defendant. And as a result, it is thought that the protections necessary at a violation of probation hearing prior to incarceration might be somewhat less. And a police officer is not so much that way. He is much more involved in the prosecutorial aspect of the case. He is a partisan of the victim in this particular case, Your Honor.
May I interrupt here? Getting back to the whole fast-track notion, if I understand you, you're saying that by fast-track, it simply means that when someone is charged with a new crime, they get brought in for a VOP as opposed to waiting to see what happens in the trial for the new crime.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And, you know, there are probably a lot of good reasons for doing that, but one of the reasons for doing that might be that depending upon what amount of sentence could be imposed upon a finding of a VOP, it makes it easier for the state because, hey, you know, we just have to go in and the standard of proof is lower, and if we get them on a VOP and the judge decides to give him a maximum sentence or even a significant sentence as a result of that, then we can just drop the criminal trial for the second set of charges. Do you know if that is, in fact, the way it's operating, that generally when somebody is brought in on a fast-track VOP for a second charge, that the second charge ultimately gets dropped and the state just goes with the VOP decision?
My personal experience, Your Honor, that is not generally how it occurs.
So they get them both times?
Yes. Okay. That is, and if they get the second
right.
time. But the, that has happened in a case such I did not cite, Perry versus State, that happened some time ago, where the state prosecuted at a VOP based on some contempt charges and then dropped the case immediately after that, and that's a reported decision. That I do not think and cannot represent to the court and would not accuse the state of doing that. I don't think that they do that. But as in domestic cases, I can tell you that my experience is, especially with domestic violence cases, it happens very frequently that the state is not able to go forward on the day of trial. So a person who's on probation has had their liberty curtailed, as in Mr. Collins' case, and then the witnesses upon whose basis the violation has been found aren't there, and we can't decide whether or not they were telling the truth or telling a lie.
Has he served his sentence?
Mr. Collins has served this sentence.
I mean, is every part of it?
Which part? Of this case, every part of it's done. Yes. Of this part, particular case, Your Honor.
So what happens if we agree with you?
What happens is Mr. Collins is on probation for something else right now. And he will serve his, I believe he's on level 3 probation currently.
Well, I mean, what happens in this case? What are you asking us to do to...
I'm asking you to reverse his sentence and send it back to the court for an appropriate hearing. That is what I'm asking you to do.
And then what would happen?
Well, that would be up to Judge Johnston, but I imagine she would have a violation hearing and determine the status of it, how he's doing on probation currently, and either the state would be able to call this lady, the witnesses in, which probably would not occur, and the violation would probably be dropped. That's a guess.
So there are possible outcomes that could involve the reinstatement of probation again?
Yes, Your Honor. Probation can be violated. My understanding of the law is that probation can be violated at any time, and the court is given broad discretion as to how it can deal with a person's behavior. But I do not, the state would have to process the case differently. And given the fact that the case was dismissed at trial for the failure of the witnesses to appear, I think it unlikely that they would go forward. But what someone else is going
to
do.
In the deep recesses of my mind, going back to when I was on Superior Court, I believe it was possible for someone to be violated for merely being arrested. They didn't have to be convicted. There just had to be reason to believe that they had committed the crime. Does that not apply to Mr. Collins?
That's a series of questions, Your Honor. I would venture to disagree a little bit with the court's rule as stated, and simply say that my understanding of violations of probation rules is that it isn't a violation to get arrested. It can be a violation to fail to report an arrest. And furthermore, if it is shown at a violation of probation hearing that his behavior is not what it should have been on probation based upon his commission of a new crime, through competent evidence, I would submit, as described in the Brown case, then the court can violate him. There doesn't have to be an actual conviction. I'm not arguing that there has to be an actual conviction. I'm simply arguing that Mr. Collins' probation has been terminated on a basis that is simply too untrustworthy, as the Brown court described it. I would submit that his due process rights have been violated, even though the Brown decision fails to, or not fails to, it simply doesn't say that.
Well, can you tell me that it was not a condition of Mr. Collins' probation when this occurred that he not be arrested during the period of his probation?
I can tell you that it is my belief that that is not a condition of probation.
Okay. So the issue for us becomes, does Brown apply in this case?
Yes, sir.
And whether the police officer's physical observation of a break-in and damage to property inside sufficiently corroborates what he was told by the ex-girlfriend and the aunt to justify his conviction for violation of probation.
If Your Honor, yes, Your Honor, that could be a ruling that, or an issue in which you frame, how you frame the case. But that would involve, I believe, overruling the basic rule of Brown, which states that there has to be some other evidence, at least as I've argued that the rule should be interpreted. My argument is essentially that the evidence, the non-hearsay evidence, has to be accusatory of my client.
Yeah, well, your argument goes to the, while there may be corroboration that an incident occurred, there's no corroboration of the identification of your client as the person who committed the acts.
That's correct.
And then the other side of the coin is, as I understand it, that there's some corroboration of the story that was told by the alleged eyewitnesses, and that that is sufficient corroboration to satisfy Brown.
And that is the state's argument, Your Honor.
Now, the only thing I'm losing from your argument so far, and perhaps it's my fault, but I didn't quite get the distinction between why there's looser standards for probation officers and a different standard for an investigating police officer in terms of the, let's call it the quality of the hearsay that's admissible. Well, can you explain that to me again?
I can, Your Honor, and I realize that's probably not very fair because it comes from my reading of a case that I did not cite when I was looking at last night as I was preparing for this hearing. I didn't know if it was appropriate for me to mention a case. But in Gagnon versus Scarpelli, which is the primary Supreme Court of the United States case, which applies the due process clause to violation of probation hearings, it specifically enunciates the rationale as to why a violation of probation hearing has that lower standard. And it says that one of the reasons is that probation officers stand in a different position to their clients than police officers and prosecutors stand in relation to criminal defendants. And therefore, while the standard of due process is, as they put it, minimum or minimal, it nevertheless does exist. And in that particular case, as well as in the rule which Delaware has, Rule 32.1 of the Delaware Criminal Rules, outlining the nature of the hearing for a violation of probation, it does require that there be some form of confrontation with an adverse witness. I think that that the rule, it looks like I'm into my rebuttal time, Your Honor. I don't know if you want me to proceed and finish answering the question.
I can read the case independently and develop your thought, and we'll find out whether Mr. Donovan needs an opportunity to address that case since it wasn't cited when he speaks. We'll reserve the rest of your time for you.
Thank you very much, Ron.
Good afternoon. Mr. Donovan and I have talked about this case a few times before today. And I really don't think we have a great deal of that we disagree a lot on some of the problems that are presented by this case and by violation of probation hearings generally. And I suppose what we're asking is for guidance from this court as to what is permissible and what is not. What is, Ray Brown talks about over and over again, competent evidence. And Brown seems to stand for the proposition that hearsay is not quite competent evidence, but then in Brown there is nothing but hearsay. We have a probation officer reading, and then Justice Herman, emphasizes reading from newspaper accounts in addition to the police report. I mean, this is how the violation is established, and of course, the case was decided in 1968, and cases aren't decided in a vacuum. 1968, I was 19, it was an exciting time to be alive. The courts were very active, and the case involves abortion, and I think all that has to be taken into account. I don't think the court was very happy with this particular case and with this particular violation, and neither was Superior Court. Made a special point of releasing the defendant on bail pending appeal. But
do you agree that there was no direct or circumstantial evidence of any kind, apart from the hearsay statements of the alleged victim and the aunt, that identify the Mr. Collins as the perpetrator of the crime?
No, all that comes from the complaining witness and the aunt. The officer interviewed them shortly after the event, and as I pointed out in my brief, he was not, you know, totally incompetent witness. I mean, he observed things himself. He would have been an eyewitness to the aftermath of the incident, the damage that had been done, so he could testify that it certainly appeared the crime that the complaining witness talked about had been committed. The door had been broken in, and the receiver of the telephone and the figurine had been smashed. So the physical evidence corroborated what the complaining witness said, and then that was further corroborated by the statement of the act. So unlike the case in Brown, and as the trial judge pointed out, hearing judge pointed out in distinguishing the facts of this case from Brown, we're not dealing with double hearsay here. We're dealing with a witness with knowledge, and the judge found that these facts were...
Well, wait a minute. You're not dealing with double hearsay. We're dealing with single hearsay.
Yes, yes, exactly, and in Brown it was all double hearsay, newspaper reports, and probation officer reading from the police officer's report, rather than the police officer testify, or the journalist, I'm not quite sure how that would fly, but the court found in Brown that was not competent evidence standing alone. There had to be something more. And I think Superior Court judges have wondered exactly what the something. Well, I know the judge in this case has said, well, there's some controversy here. I mean, it's not all cut and dry. What's necessary? What does constitute competent evidence? But one of the unreported cases that I attached there is Santiago, for example. That case, now that was a Rule 26C, but in that case, one probation officer simply read from the report of the defendant's probation officer. Now, I'm not quite sure how that's distinguishable from Brown, but that was held to be competent evidence to sustain the violation. And then the other case, Hester, a violation was a flunking urinalysis for drug use. Well, the person who performed the urinalysis, the lab technician, didn't testify.
What should be the standard of review that this court applies to the decisions of what you refer to as the hearing judges in these probation cases in determining what is and what isn't corroborated competent or incompetent evidence? However we may articulate the rule, what should be the standard of review?
Well, traditionally it has been abuse of discretion, and I think it should remain that because the judge has to have a certain amount of flexibility, it seems to me. For example, in this case, identity really doesn't seem to be a problem. I mean, everything really does point to the ex-boyfriend, that is Donnell Collins. Not only the testimony of the two eyewitnesses, but just the kind of crime, that senseless act of vandalism, just acting out that kind of thing. I mean, everything does seem to point to him. And of course, the eyewitnesses know Donnell Collins. I mean, there's no chance of misidentification, unless they're both lying. It was Donnell Collins that he did these deeds. But in another case, the identity of the perpetrator might be an issue. And in that case, the judge may want a higher standard.
What I'm thinking about here is, in any way in which you change the facts in the crucible for the hearing judge, if, for example, it's simply the ex-girlfriend and not the aunt saying it's Darnell, that might have some effect on the trial judge weighing of whether or not there's sufficient corroboration to make it competent evidence.
Yeah.
Here it's both the ex-girlfriend who may or may not have some reason to get her former boyfriend in trouble, but it's his own aunt who then says the same thing. Are those the kinds of issues we should leave to the trial judge to determine that it's competent evidence because it's sufficiently in the minds of that trial judge corroborated? Or do we need to articulate a rule that cuts a fine distinction between identifying a person and corroboration by a police officer of independent physical evidence that corroborates some elements of the crime but doesn't speak to identification?
I do agree with what Your Honor said initially, that there has to be a discretion for the judge to decide on a case-by-case basis what evidence is competent here. As Your Honor pointed out in this case, well, the only witness had been the complaining witness, and the judge could have said, well, maybe since it's the ex-girlfriend, maybe she was just trying to get her ex-boyfriend in trouble. But in this case, we have an independent witness, a relative of the defendant, and because of that, I'm going to say that the evidence was sufficient under the I think the judge using preponderance of the evidence standard, and I've seen that in other violation hearings too, by a preponderance of the evidence.
Well, can you articulate for us what you believe the current Brown rule to be? What is the holding of Brown as the state understands it?
As I understand it, a violation cannot be based solely on hearsay. In other words, you can't simply have, say in this case, a police officer totally unconnected with this investigation, sort of like in a grand jury. You know, just have the police officer go ahead and read off one report after another, having no personal knowledge of it whatsoever. I would say that under Brown, and under the facts of Brown, that would be held to be incompetent evidence. And as Justice Risley pointed out, that would be double hearsay. Reading off the report, which no doubt would contain statements of witnesses. But there is all, unless it's going to be a full-blown trial, I mean, I would hesitate to adopt my friend Mr. Goff's rule that identification testimony has to be established basically beyond a reasonable doubt with the full panoply of trial protections.
Well, should there be a symmetry from holding somebody to a crime to sending them to prison for a crime, in the sense that the probable cause at a preliminary hearing has two prongs to it: probable cause that a crime was committed and probable cause that the defendant committed it.
Yeah.
So why not at the other end of the spectrum? Shouldn't there be a requirement of competent evidence that a crime was committed and competent evidence that the defendant committed the crime without having pure hearsay for either of those prongs?
Oh, I perfectly agree. I mean, there should be for both prongs, both on the issue of identity and the issue of...
Because what I just suggested was that hearsay alone on identification would not be sufficient.
Well, I think what the officer witnessed here goes to identification additionally. And some of the... Again, I'm talking about who the witnesses are. Obviously, they know the defendant. It's not a case of somebody, a stranger, trying to identify somebody else from say, a photographic lineup or from a description of what clothing so-and-so is wearing. So here we have people who obviously know the defendant. And just the nature of the crime sort of points to somebody, not a stranger crime whatsoever, but a crime committed by someone who knows the complaining witness and rather intimately. So, now Collins says...
Let me try to restate at least the alternatives that are dancing in my mind. A bright line rule, which Brown may be, that no uncorroborated hearsay may be admitted in a violation of probation hearing for the purpose of finding that the defendant has violated his or her probation. Or the rule should be in the discretion of the trial judge. The trial judge will determine if the evidence is wholly hearsay on any particular issue of relevance. The trial judge, in his or her discretion, can determine the trustworthiness of that hearsay given the facts and circumstances in a particular case. Are those really the two? Maybe clearly they could be stated more articulately than I just did, but are those basically the two competing standards here?
Well, Chief Justice, other than the Your Honor's use of bright line rule, I don't think the two, as you articulated them, really are at odds. Both invest a great deal of discretion in the trial judge under the facts of each individual case. But yes, I do think that if Brown stands for any kind of bright line rule at all, it does stand for the totally uncorroborated hearsay is not competent evidence to sustain a violation of probation hearing. But exactly what degree of corroboration is necessary should be left up to the broad discretion of the hearing judge under the facts of each particular case. And in some cases, the judge may decide, well, in this particular case, all hearsay on this particular issue, identity, amount of damage, whatever, is not competent. I mean, there should be somebody here to talk about that issue under the facts of this case, and yet in another case say, well, I will accept hearsay on this because of these other factors. But that's, I think, should be left up to the discretion and the broad discretion of the trial judge, or the hearing judge. If I may, I think this is simply a case that is now pending before this court, and I just happened to, it's a Rule 26C brief, and I filed the answer to it last week, and I think the court should be aware of it. It's Lonnie Eckenrode versus State, and it's number 345, 2005, and as I say, it's a Rule 26C brief, and the facts are basically indistinguishable from this case. And it's the defendant who actually, in his points he wants the court to consider, brings up the hearsay problem. But again, this was filed by a competent defense attorney who looked at this as my very competent good friend Mr. Goff looked at it and came up with an entirely different conclusion that this is okay. And this is exactly the same situation, really. The police officer testified, it was a new crime, the police officer investigated the crime, saw some corroborating evidence, picked up the hammer that was apparently used in the attacks, all the damage to the victim, and testified to such at the hearing, and there was no, I mean, the victims themselves did not testify, and as was the case here, strangely enough, the charges eventually were dropped. So, I mean, just as far as facts go, I mean, this Eckenrode case is on all fours, but just as an example of how the, I think the bar perhaps is will be confused about what exactly is competent evidence under Brown and in the cases that follow Brown in one of these violation hearings.
Well, let me put the question to you directly. Let's assume we require that there must be something other than hearsay to identify and link a probationer to an actual crime. What's wrong with that rule?
Well, again, I think, again, Your Honor is concentrating on one particular aspect of the crime, or I'll call it an element for want of anything else. I realize, now, strictly speaking, it's not an element, but we'll say you have to prove that the perpetrator was a defendant, so it's only going to be an element of the offense. And my position is that, again, it's going to vary from case to case how central that element is. In this case here, I don't think it is all that central due to the, again, the, I'm not going to go through them again, the factors that I've mentioned a number of times. In another case, it may be.
Well,
and I think
direct,
it should be.
Can we have a direct denial by the defendant that this happened?
Well, certainly. I'm not going to place much on that. I don't think. You know, not every defendant comes in and says, I did it. Sometimes they actually do deny it.
Well, but to vary the facts just slightly, if in this case, in addition to finding damage that was consistent with there having been a crime committed, there was, you know, some article of clothing that was identified as being the defendant's clothing at the scene of the crime. And, you know, the explanation could be that, well, that was from before we had a relationship or whatever. So I'm not saying it would have been dispositive, but at least then there would be something that ties this defendant to this alleged crime, even though he says, it wasn't me, I wasn't there, I didn't do it. And then at a VOP hearing, you would have some corroboration without it necessarily requiring the testimony of either of the complaining witnesses, but it would be more than just hearsay as to who committed this crime. But we don't even have something like that. We have absolutely nothing that puts him at the crime scene other than the testimony of the people who aren't present.
But that is true. And obviously the officer doesn't know this man from Adam. And can't say from their own personal appearance, oh yeah, this is the kind of thing this guy does, or something like that. I mean, the officer has nothing, no knowledge of the defendant here, Mr. Collins, whatsoever. At least he appears so. However, again, I mean, Your Honor mentioned that there was nothing, and I again, going back to, you know, the nature of the crime and the types of witnesses, I think there is some corroboration as to identity here. I mean, it's not just somebody out of the blue that came in off the street and did this. I mean, it is the ex-boyfriend. And it's a kind of spite crime that one would expect in a romantic relationship gone sour. So I think there is some corroboration from the nature of the crime. As to the identity of the perpetrator. The court has no other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I just have a few additional comments about some things that some points that Mr. Donovan was making in this manner.
Well, before you finish your time, articulate the rule for us that you believe we should adopt, given Brown.
I believe that the rule that you should adopt is that due process requires that there be some non-hearsay evidence which proves that my client or a probationer violated his probation, that his behavior wasn't what it should be on probation. And that evidence, I would submit, was not produced at that hearing. And I would base that both in the Brown decision, because I believe that rule would be consistent with it, and also in the probation violation rule 32.1, which says that a person at a hearing has the right to be confronted by the witness against him. And a gloss on that rule could be that it must be the true witness against him, not just a police officer reciting facts that someone else gave him during an interview, which took place prior to even any interview of the defendant in that case. That is my suggestion.
And that rule, if I understand the way you articulated it, whether it's based on Rule 32 or whether it's based on Brown, would be that no hearsay evidence, even when corroborated in some way by independent evidence, would be admissible, wouldn't it?
No, Your Honor, I apologize if that's
the impression I gave. Well, if you put it in the context of being confronted by the witnesses against you, isn't that what you're saying?
That is not what I'm saying, Your Honor. I believe that hearsay is freely admissible at a violation of probation hearing. And at any sentencing hearing, as long as it meets some basic reliability standards. I think that's the general rule for sentencings. But I think that the rule I'm saying is that there has to be some additional evidence on the issue of whether or not my client, whether or not a probationer himself violated the probation. There has to be something that either the probation officer knows, sees, has knowledge of. And I think in the Santiago case, the distinction is that when you have a piece of paper which has a lab reading in it, which would be admissible hearsay anyway, that's very reliable evidence. There's no real basis. The biggest problem with giving a general rule, which I think the state is arguing against the bright line rule, is that and generally that rule exists because trial judges see the witnesses and can assess their credibility and their demeanor. And they can't in this set of circumstances, so that witness was not there. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.